So, yeah, this is the title of the talk. It's work that I've done with Kostas Kanderis and Sergei Solodukhin. That part is about reconstruction of the bulk from CFT data. And then I'll present some work in progress with Giovanni Arcioni and Martin O'Loughlin about high energy scattering in ADS. So here is an outline of the talk. So I'll first give some motivation, and then I'll explain how to reconstruct the bulk from certain CFT data. So first I will have to solve a Dirichlet problem in the bulk given some boundary conditions at infinity. Then I will work out formula for the holographic stress energy tensor, and then I'll explain how to include matter in the system and also back reaction of that matter on the geometry. And then the second part, I will first briefly review the issue of holographic scattering in asymptotically flat spacetimes. I will show how to generalize these results for the case of ADS. And I'll discuss the possible relation with a boundary theory. So here are some questions that I would like to answer. The motivation is to understand better holography. So we have this dictionary in the ADS CFT correspondence, and would like to have a very precise prescription. So part of the talk will be about how to sharpen this dictionary. But then we would also like to understand whether there is something like holography in asymptotically flat spaces. One idea about holography in asymptotically flat spaces comes from scattering near black holes, as considered by Etoft, where he considers scattering between massless particles in the neighborhood of a black hole, and then he found that the S matrix that you find is actually, you get at the end of the day, you get the Veneziano amplitude, and it is related to a two-dimensional field theory, which is defined on a Euclidean surface. So the question will be, can we do something like this in spaces with a negative cosmological constant, and is it in any way related to the CFT? So the properties of the ADS CFT that I will be discussing will be, first of all, how to reconstruct the bulk theory given CFT data. So that means, in particular, how to reconstruct the metric in the bulk and also the fields that are in the bulk. The answer is that the information that we need is apart from the source, so apart from the boundary condition. We also need information about the stress energy tensor and about the dual operators in the case of matter. I will do this same thing in the case of back reaction. And in that case, we will find we will find that the stress energy tensor in the CFT is not conserved. So there is that has to do with a word identity. And also we can ask the opposite question, namely if I'm given a space-time with a negative cosmological constant satisfying either the pure Einstein's equations or maybe with some matter fields in it, how do I reconstruct, what information can I get from that about the CST, and where is that information encoded? And it turns out that it is encoded in a perturbative expansion of the field, of the bulk field, as we approach the boundary. So to answer these questions, we will need to solve Einstein's equations perturbatively in the distance to the boundary. We will also find, we will also need to give a renormalized ADS CFT prescription, which works also in the case of matter and back reaction. And then the second part of the talk will be about this high energy scattering. So the first question that I will ask will be whether you can consistently describe this high energy limit in ADS. And well, the answer is yes. It turns out that in ADS you have an extra dimensionful parameter, so you have to keep track of the different dimensionful parameters that you have, and then it turns out that there is a regime where you can describe high energy scattering from gravity only. Then the next question will be, is the theory that you get at the end of the day, is it topological? Does it live on the ADS boundary? And then we'll see that in some cases the action reduces to a boundary action, and it lives on the boundary of ADS. And there are some cases where we don't yet have a proof, so that's still a work in progress. And of course, the questions that I would like to answer is whether there is a relation between this boundary action that you find and some effective CFT action. This is still a work in progress. So let me start with the reconstruction of space-time from the CFT. So this ADS CFT statement is that the partition function of string theory with some boundary conditions imposed on the fields should be equal to the to computing correlation functions in the CFT with some sources that couple to some operators. And in particular, I will be interested in the large n limit, where I can use the subtle point approximation. In the bulk, one finds that the fields in general can be decomposed into normalizable and non-normalizable modes. The non-normalizable modes correspond to classical sources in the boundary, on the boundary, whereas the normalizable modes are the fluctuating piece, and will be a part of the talk to make this a little bit more precise. And I will do this computation for the metric and also for scalar fields in the bulk, and I think I will skip point particles. So I'm not going to discuss any specific CFT. I will only use generic properties. In particular, I will need to specify what sources we turn on in the CFT, so that there will be some boundary metric and some asymptotic values of the value of the scalar field. And specification of this information will allow me to solve the Einstein's equations coupled to matter in the bulk perturbatively to high enough order so that we can get all the infrared divergences. Of course, we need to renormalize these divergences. And if we want to go one order higher in this expansion, we need to include also information about the dual operator. So this is the kind of solutions I'm looking at. So the metric, the boundary metric has an expansion in terms of the distance to the boundary, so there's some boundary condition, and the same for the scalar fields. And these coefficients are determined through Einstein's equations from the lowest order coefficients. And then this expansion breaks down at some order where you find the expectation value of the dual operators appearing. And well, this would correspond to the usual statement about defining a Cauchy problem. So in general, since these are second order equations, in general, we need to specify the boundary condition and also the velocity. So this would correspond to specifying two boundary conditions on the field.
So just remind me what you mean by saying that the expansion breaks down?
It means that the coefficient that is sitting here, I'll make this more precise.
Lower coefficient.
Yeah, it's not determined.
So G2 and so on are all fixed by G0 and moving up to F.
Yeah. So here is the Dirichlet problem. So I'm solving Einstein's equations in the bulk. For the time being, I'm considering pure gravity. I take this form of the metric. So the boundaries here at R0. This is the ADS radius, and this is the boundary metric. So the indices I and j refer to the boundary metric. I work in ADS d plus 1, so that the boundary is d-dimensional, and then I have a boundary condition for the metric. So the metric at infinity, when we extract this second order pole, is given by g-naught. So that is my boundary condition, and here are Einstein's equations. I have a slight change of notation here. This rho is simply r squared. The prime is means derivatives with respect to rho, and here there should be indices I and j everywhere, so I'm using an index-free notation. So this is the ij component of Einstein's equations, this is the ir component, and this is the rr component. And so I look for solutions of this form, and as I said, the expansion breaks down, which means that this coefficient is not determined, and you have to include an extra piece, a logarithmic term with a certain coefficient h. So, and then this is the way you solve the equations. For odd dimensions, there is no logarithmic term, so this h simply vanishes. That is also related to the fact that the conformal anomalies in odd dimension vanish. And in even dimensions, the Taylor expansion breaks down, so you have to include this logarithmic term. So now we solve Einstein's equations order by order, perturbatively in rho, and then G2 up to GD minus 2 and H are all determined uniquely in terms of G0. So here I wrote down two of the expression for G2 and G4, so they are all local functions of the boundary curvature and derivatives of the curvature. But the coefficient GD, the special coefficient, is not completely determined by the equations. Its trace is determined in terms of the lower order coefficients, and its divergence is also determined. But for its traceless part, we need extra information from the CFT.
Once you specify that extra information, you can explicitly see that all the rest of the expansion is determined?
No. So I'm, in general, I'm stopping at this order. So okay.
It should be determined, right?
In principle, it should be determined, although you know that if you go much higher up, then you're going to need to include also higher order corrections to the Einstein-Hilbert action.
Right.
So it is a question whether this would make sense. But in principle, it seems like it should be determined at least under reasonable assumptions for the boundary metric, like that it doesn't contain singularities and things like that. But actually, I will work out a case where you can actually solve the equations to all orders. So here is the equation satisfied by GD, this special coefficient which was not determined. So its divergence is equal to a total divergence of, again, some tensor A, which is a local functional of the boundary curvature. And of course, we can integrate this equation like this, and then there is some unknown, some integration constant T, which should be conserved by definition. And we can also compute its trace, because as I said, the trace of chi was known. So we can, from this equation, we can compute the trace of T, and it turns out to be exactly equal to the conformal anomaly. So this already suggests that this T could be related to the stress energy tensor, and that I will show in the next transparencies. So this was for ADS3 and ADS6, ADS5. For ADS7, the equation looks a little bit more complicated. So it now contains a term which is not a total derivative. But again, it can be solved. It can be integrated to this form, and this S is now again a local function of the curvature. For odd boundary dimensions, then G is simply traceless and conserved. So what we have learned from this is that specification of the sources is not enough to solve the bulk equations of motion that was expected. We need this extra tensor T. And now the question is, what does this T correspond to from the CFT point of view? So I will now show that it is equal to the stress energy tensor. So we know how to compute the stress energy tensor, since according to the ADS-CFT correspondence, the on-shell supergravity action should be the effective action in the CFT. So if we take the derivative with respect to the metric, that should give us the stress energy tensor. But of course, this action has divergences. It has infrared divergences, so we have to renormalize it. Regularize it and renormalize it. So I regularize the action by imposing a cutoff at some finite epsilon, and then you can work out the expression for the on-shell action. It has some divergences, like powers of 1 over epsilon. It also contains a logarithmic divergence. And then we renormalize it in the usual way by adding covariant counterterms, which are functionals of the boundary curvature only. And then when you work out at the end of the day, you find that the stress energy tensor as given by this expression is equal to this special coefficient GD plus some other functional X, which is a known functional of the boundary metric. And if you plug in the expressions for GD and for X, then you find that T is indeed equal to the tensor T that we had before. And of course, it is conserved, and that its trace gives the conformal anomaly.
You're saying again, if I specify T, or this subleading power, and mm-hmm. then I solve for G, and then I go through this procedure, and I compute the stress tensor, and I get back the T I started with.
Because
you said that GD was undetermined unless you specify.
Yeah.
Unless you give extra
data. Right. So, yeah, what I'm saying here is what this specification of the data corresponds to in the CFT. Mm-hmm. So now I have learned that this data that I had to include were the data about the stress energy tensor. Yeah. And
so this is basically data you're adding at the boundary.
Sorry?
This is basically data you're adding at the boundary,
yeah,
which corresponds to the stress tensor in the CFT.
Mm-hmm.
And to get this result, do you need the finite piece?
Yes. Yeah. So you need to. You need to renormalize the stress energy tensor so that you're left with a finite piece.
But since you don't know the alloy coefficients in the expansion of the metric.
Mm-hmm.
how can you compute the finite piece?
Yeah. So you can compute it by, I mean, you don't know the you don't know the action, the finite part of, I mean, you don't know the full action, but the variation you can compute by simply by because you know the formal expression for the action in terms of the boundary metric. So you can take that derivative, and then it turns out that you only need to compute that finite part. The only thing you need is that specific coefficient. So here are the expressions for this tensor X written in terms of these coefficients G0, G2, etc. So what we have learned is that given any bulk solution, we can expand the metric in a power expansion in R. And then from that, we can find the dual stress energy tensor. And of course, as I said, also the other way around. So specifying the source and the stress energy tensor gives us enough information to solve the equations of motion up to a certain order. Now, there is a case where you can solve the equations of motion to all orders, and that is when the wild tensor in the bulk vanishes. So in that case, you find that the perturbation expansion simply stops at a certain point, and this coefficient GD is determined from the lower order coefficients. So in particular, you find an expression for this T in terms of all the lower order coefficients, and that also gives you, of course, an expression for the stress energy tensor in these kinds of space-times. So you can also look at conformal transformation properties of the stress energy tensor. From the literature, it was known for these two and these four for conformally flat metrics, and the results agree with that. So now I will include matter in the system.
So before you do that, so you said sort of the goal was to reconstruct the bulk theory. I guess the question is to what extent you've done that. Now, I can imagine sort of various answers to that question. You could say reconstruct, say, scattering amplitudes in the bulk or some other characterization of the quantum theory in the bulk. And I don't think you've done that. It looks like you're trying to reconstruct the classical metric in the bulk.
So yeah.
And even that, it's not clear you're doing, since you haven't nailed down the question of whether you determine all these higher coefficients.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because those coefficients are part of the, they become important as you try to go into the center of the
GF. Yeah. So what we,
so in what sense are you constructing this?
Yeah. So for the general case, I'm reconstructing just part of it, just enough in order to get this infrared diversion part of the action. So that's for the general case. If you want to reconstruct everything, then in general, as I said, you will also need higher corrections to the action.
Just to construct the bulk, say, classical metric, and even then you're a long ways from the bulk sort of quantum theory.
But for these conformally flat metrics, the result is exact, so you really can, then you get the full metric for that case. Yeah, so...
isn't there just one metric with vanishing one curvature? ADS itself?
In that case, no. It turns out that ADS would be for a boundary metric that is Minkowski. Well, it is flat, but you can also include curved metrics on the boundary, and then you get more complicated.
All these curved things you just get by deformorphism. You do complicated deformorphism. You start with ADS. Do complicated deformorphism, changing metric on the boundary.
No, not really. You I mean, you start with some boundary metric, and in particular, you can consider two metrics which are not related by diffeomorphisms. For the case of matter, this is matter in a fixed background. Well, the pattern that we find is more or less the same. So knowledge of the sources allows us to determine the divergent part of the action only. And then for the finite part, we need the expectation value of this dual operator. I will consider here a scalar fields with some mass. They have some asymptotic expansion in terms of R. So here the expansion starts at a different order from the gravitational case. You find that all these coefficients phi 2 up to a certain phi, and also this logarithmic term, are determined from phi 0. This special coefficient phi 2 delta minus d is not determined by the equations of motion, and it is related to the matter conformal anomaly in the CFT. To determine it, you need again the expectation value of the dual operator. You can compute that by computing the derivative of the action, and that is exactly equal to this coefficient. And again, here there is in general a logarithmic term. If you include back reaction, then things become a little bit more complicated. So you now have to solve the coupled system of Einstein's equations and matter equations. So here are Einstein's equations with the source. So here, this is the stress energy tensor for a scalar field with some mass. The first thing you find is that for delta larger than d, this delta was related to the mass of the scalar field, the perturbative expansion breaks down, so you cannot solve the equations perturbatively, and that is because the right-hand side comes with some power of rho, some negative power of delta. So when delta becomes too large, this diverges, and you cannot cancel it by a perturbative expansion there. And that corresponds to the statement in the CFT that these operators with this dimension correspond to relevant perturbations. For fields of smaller dimension, you can solve the equations perturbatively, and then you more or less find the same, a similar kind of pattern. So the stress energy tensor is related again to these coefficients, G2, and the dual operator is related to this phi 2, psi 2. But now, in this case, and all other coefficients are determined again. But in this case, the stress energy tensor is not conserved. So its conservation law involves the expectation value of the dual operator and the derivative of the source. And this has to do with the fact that now there is a flux of energy from the bulk to the boundary or vice versa, so that the boundary theory is not isolated, but it is coupled to some source which adds energy to the system. So any other questions at this point? So I will skip point particles, and then I want you to go into this high energy scattering. Let me first say a few words about black holes. The motivation for this high energy scattering regime was the Hawking information paradox. So So it is well known that when you have two observers, one is accelerated and the other is at rest, the states as seen by the different observers are related by a so-called Bogoliubov transformation, so that the vacuum of one observer is corresponds to a superposition of particle states to of the other observer, so that this observer sees a thermal state, in whereas this observer sees a vacuum. So now, well, what Hawking argued was that when you have a black hole, the black hole will evaporate, and then at the end of the day, you're left with only a mixed state, even if you started with a pure state. And one of the proposals to resolve this paradox has been to, well, the S-matrix ansatz, so to include the back reaction of the infalling particles on the geometry. These infalling particles will shift the trajectories of outgoing particles by an amount that is proportional to the momentum of those ingoing particles. So in particular, if you're able to measure the shift of the outgoing particles, you're able to, well, then you can get back the information at least about the momentum, the momentum profile that went in. So what you have to do to include this back reaction is well, what you get is a so-called shockwave geometry. So here is the stress energy tensor for a massless particle with traveling along the v direction with momentum p. So so I have my Lycoln coordinates like this. This is the u coordinate, and this is the v direction. The particle is sitting at u is zero, so it's traveling along this direction. And here is I make this ansatz for the metric. It contains a delta singularity at the trajectory of the particle. And if you plug this in into Einstein's equations, and for the time being I do this for a zero cosmological constant, then Einstein's equations reduce to these two conditions. The first condition simply tells you that the direction of motion of the particle, this v direction, is an isometry of the metric, so the metric is not allowed to depend on v. And this is a junction condition for the shift here. So what is happening here is that you start with some space-time. Consider, for example, Minkowski space-time. And then I include a massless particle by cutting the space-time along this edge here, and I paste the two pieces again with a relative shift. So this is flat space-time, and this is also flat, and here I have a shift f. And this equation for f tells you how to paste those pieces of space-time. It turns out that for negative cosmological constant, there is no solution to these equations. But there is a slightly different ansatz, but very similar to this one, which was found by Horowitz and Itzhaki, which just does this. So it also includes a delta function and some profile function f. But now the different feature of this metric is that it is allowed to depend on the transverse coordinates rho. So rho is here the transverse coordinate. So again, from Einstein's equations, you get an equation for the shift function f, and if you solve it, then you find these solutions for ADS 3, 4, and 5. And you can see that, you can easily check that the Minkowski limit, the flat space limit, is obtained when the transverse distance divided by the ADS radius goes to zero. So in that case, for example, for ADS 4, this just goes to 1, so you get the usual logarithmic term like in Minkowski space. So in the case of Minkowski space, the host was able to compute an S matrix for collisions between such two particles. So collisions between particles that interact gravitationally through these shock waves. What he did was to compute the trajectories of test particles in this geometry. So you find that along the v direction there is a shift at u is zero, so there's a step function here. This simply means that the particles travel along straight lines in this part, and then when they hit the singularity here, they get shifted and they continue along a straight line. And there is also a transverse effect, an effect in the transverse plane, which is a refraction effect. But this effect is subdominant in the impact parameter because it goes like the derivative of f instead of f. So when the impact parameter, so when the distance between the two particles is very large, you can neglect this term. So from this, Etoft derived an S matrix for the evolution from a state with initial momentum p in and final momentum p out, and then he found that it was equal to some shift factor proportional to the momenta, and this could be written in this way in a bicentrical form. So it looks very much like a nonlinear sigma model on a Euclidean world sheet. So this transverse coordinates x would be the transverse coordinates on the shock wave, and in fact when you compute the amplitude, you find that it is equal to the Veneziano amplitude, only that you have an imaginary string tension that is proportional to Newton's constant. So.
Sorry, can I step back a bit? I'm sort of confused. Why the Hawking gradation, why you're modeling that by the shock waves?
Right. So, up to now, this was done, I mean, this specific computation is done for a Minkowski background. You can do it for a Schwarzschild black hole so that you have a black hole. So you have something like this. And then, so here's the horizon. And then ingoing particles are traveling, are going inwards like that. And then the horizon is expanding as the, with the shift function f, as the particles go in and modify the geometry. And outgoing particles get shifted by that amount. But this is really, sort of cartoon of a total S matrix, because here you are considering small perturbations on a black hole. So it's not really, you're not really doing a formation of a black hole, but just considering small perturbations of that.
But the shock waves are, you're going the shock waves into the black hole.
Yeah. So.
Okay, so if the Hawking radiation sort of hits right in the middle of the shock wave and never sort of makes it out, it gets shifted inside? Is that what?
That could happen. That depends on the transverse distance between the particles. I mean, there are cases where particles are trapped back and cases where they go out, but they go out at later times. So, now the question is, let me first review a different approach to this high energy regime. This is a paper by Erik and Herman Verlinde, where they consider exactly this type of situation, but in a slightly more general setting. So they consider scattering at high energies, but at small momentum transfer. And they do that only with the Einstein-Hilbert action. So at first, one would think that you need to include higher order corrections. You may need the full quantum gravity or even string theory to describe high energy collisions. And the argument goes as follows. If you So if you consider, if you go to dimensionless coordinates, so that all the dimensionful, well, all the dependence on dimensions is in the metric, then the metric will scale in general like the square of the typical size of the system that you are considering. So if you plug that in into the Einstein-Hilbert action in four dimensions, then you see that it goes like the square of this length scale. And since you have Newton's constant over here, you find that the coupling constant of the Einstein-Hilbert action will be the Planck length over the typical size of the system. So you expect that when the size of the system becomes very small, of the order of the Planck length, then you are in a non-perturbative regime, and then you need the full quantum gravity, or perhaps the full string theory. What the Verlinders argued was that there's still a regime of this high energy scattering where you can still make sense of the Einstein-Hilbert action. And that is exactly the regime where even if the total energy is high, the transfer of momentum is small. So in that case, you have not one but two coupling constants. And well, they showed that this is exactly the regime that Ed Hoft was considering. So the transfer of momentum is much smaller than the center of mass energy. So this is the regime that I'm going to consider next. And then, so they, well, they split the coordinates into a longitudinal and transverse direction. So there are two longitudinal directions, which are these directions here. So that's the direction where the particles are colliding, and there is the transverse directions where effects are much lower. So the longitudinal direction goes typically like the Planck constant, whereas the transverse directions is go typically like the impact parameter. So in that sense, we are considering forward scattering. So particles are really colliding head on at zero angle. So in this regime, we have two length scales: the longitudinal length scale and the transverse length scale, and we can form two coupling constants out of that. One is the longitudinal coupling constant, which I set equal to 1, and the other is the simply because the longitudinal scale will be of the order of the Planck length, and the transverse coupling constant is much smaller than 1. So now choosing a gauge where the metric is in a two-block diagonal form. And this you can always do in four dimensions, but it can also be generalized to higher dimensions. So the metric is of this form. So here I have the longitudinal metric G alpha beta. Here is the transverse metric H ij. This is 0, and this is 0. This is a two-dimensional metric, and this is a d minus two-dimensional metric. So the longitudinal metric scales like before, like the square of the longitudinal length scale, and the transverse metric scales now like the square of the transverse length scale. So when we plug that in into the Einstein-Hilbert action like we did before, what we find is that it splits into two pieces, one which is strongly coupled and the other is weakly coupled. So this longitudinal part of the action scales under rescalings of the metric like the Planck length squared, and the transverse part scales like the transverse length squared. So this is the weakly coupled part. So for this part, we can do a weak coupling expansion. So that's what I will do next. So for we can use the equations of motion for that part of the action. So here are the equations of motion. This condition tells you that the curvature in the longitudinal space, so evaluated in this metric G, should be zero, and the transverse part of the metric is not allowed to depend on the longitudinal coordinates. So when you solve for this and plug that back in into the action, you find that the action looks like this. It still has a curvature term in terms of a transverse metric. And, well, I introduced a scalar field V, which is related, which relates transverse derivatives of the coordinates to longitudinal derivatives of the coordinates. And it acts as reparametrizations of the metric. And there is also a ghost term coming from the gauge fixing. And then in their paper, the Philinder showed that this action is a topological action. It reduces, in particular, to a boundary term. It is invariant under BRST symmetry. So the transformations of the ghost kill the fluctuations of the coordinates in the bulk, so that the only degrees of freedom that you are left with are the values of this field X at the boundary. So they in fact explicitly showed that the action can be, by some manipulations, can be written down as a purely boundary action, and it indeed only depends on this boundary values of X. So when you couple this to this was for pure gravity. If you now couple this to point particles and write down the equations of motion for this X, then you find exactly the junction condition that the Toft found before for his shockwave metric. And in fact, the Philinders were able to compute the same scattering amplitudes from this. So yeah, so that is the result. The theory reduces to a boundary theory. Now the question is, can we do the same for ADS? So I consider this iconal regime in ADS. And the first thing you notice is that there's this extra dimensional full parameter, the ADS radius, so that you have two coupling constants instead of one. So you have the ratio of the Planck length to the ADS radius and the ratio of the Planck length to the impact parameter. I denote them by N and M. So for the supergravity approximation to be valid, we need N to be much larger than 1. And for the iconal regime to be valid, so that means that the transfer of momentum is to be very small, we need M to be much larger than 1. But still, this doesn't fully specify the regime we are dealing with. We still have the ratio M over N, which can be chosen arbitrarily. So we have now two regimes. One is the regime L Planck is much smaller than L transverse is much smaller than L ADS. And the other regime is where the impact parameter is the largest length scale in the problem. So we have these regimes. One corresponds to M much larger than one than N, and the other one corresponds to M much smaller than N. And there's of course also an intermediate regime, but I won't consider that regime, because in that regime it turns out that you cannot deal with this iconal approximation in this setting. And also shockwaves develop singularities in that regime, so I will only consider these two. So now, again, like before, the metric, the longitudinal metric scales like the Planck length squared, and the transverse metric scales like the transverse length squared. And again, we can split the Einstein-Hilbert action into two terms, longitudinal and the transverse term. And of course, we have an extra term coming from the cosmological constant. Now we have to decide whether this term belongs to this part or to this part of the action. And that depends on this ratio m over n. So I will first consider what I call the strong curvature regime. So that is a regime where the AVS radius is much larger than the Planck length, but much smaller than the impact parameter. So in that regime, the cosmological constant belongs to the transverse part of the action. So this is with this assumption. So now the transverse metric is allowed to depend on the longitudinal coordinate. That was not the case in the Minkowski analysis. So now the transverse action reduces to this. So we have a scalar field, an extra scalar field chi coming from this conformal factor. So now since this is the weakly coupled part of the action, we use the subtle point approximation for that. And then we find the equations of motion. So I do some very simple field redefinition. Then we find that the action is simply two-dimensional gravity coupled to a scalar field. And here are the equations of motion. And it turns out that this action, this type of actions were considered in a paper by Banks and O'Loughlin. So they considered this class of models. And our model corresponds to a coupling of phi squared. So k is equal to 1. So that's the only restriction that we put on that model. And then it turns out that the equations of motion are exactly soluble. So I will skip some details. One can prove that the metric has a Killing vector that allows one to write it down in this form. So it only depends on the coordinate, on the space-like coordinate x. And let me recall that this is the longitudinal part of the metric, and also the scalar field phi depends only on x. So now the action reduces to a particle Lagrangian, depending only on one variable. And since this g, which is in the metric, does not contribute to the dynamics, by doing a field redefinition, we can cast the equations of motion in this form. And it turns out that they can be exactly integrated. And here are the solutions. So the field phi is proportional to some function psi, which is a combination of e powers in R. And all the same for e. It's also proportional to this psi. So this type of solutions, if you compute the curvature, for example, then you see that in general it depends on R. But if either A or B are zero, so A and B are the boundary conditions, then it reduces to AVS2. So it has a negative cosmological constant. But for the general case, it also contains black hole solutions. So these are the classical solutions that I'm dealing with, and with which I will insert back into the action. This was for the strong curvature regime, and for the weak curvature regime. So that was when the AVS radius is the largest length scale. It turns out that again the equations of motion can be solved exactly, and now you get a solution where the metric has a naked singularity here, and another solution, the other solution that you get is Rindler space, which is just a reparametrization of Minkowski space, and it turns out that these two solutions can be obtained as near horizon limits of the black hole solutions that I obtained in the strong curvature regime. So these are the solutions in the strong and weak coupling regime. So now we have to reconstruct the boundary theory. So now I do the same steps as the as in the paper by the Verlinders. We fill this weakly coupled part of the action, or sorry, the equations of motion for that. We fill into this the strong coupling, strongly coupled part of the action, and then we find this expression for the action. So it has exactly the same form as before, only that it now has an extra dependence on this scalar field chi, and that dependence is hidden here and also in this metric H. So, this chi dependence turns out to be very important, because in general it doesn't allow us to write this action as a boundary action. So let me tell you in which cases you can write it as a boundary action, at least as far as we know now. In the small curvature regime, it turns out that the action is conformally invariant, and it's not conformally invariant, it just reduces to a boundary term, like this. It is the same action that the Verlinders had before, but only there is now a cosmological term here. And now the boundary is at asymptotic infinity, because these kind of solutions were based on flat space and not on ADS space. Also, for 2 plus 1 dimensions, and in the strong curvature regime, the action is conformally invariant, and then again it reduces to a boundary action, which is here. It is very similar to the previous one, but it now contains some extra terms which make it nonlinear, very nonlinear in this field X. So before this was a quadratic action, but now we have an extra X dependence through this conformal field sigma. Now the important thing is that this action is now evaluated really at the ADS boundary. So this is a time-lag boundary. So this is the action that we would like to check whether it is related to some effective action in the conformal field theory or not. And then for the strong curvature regime and the general case, this is still work in progress. We couldn't show in the general case that the action is topological, but we are working on that, working also out the BRST transformations. So here are the conclusions. We have given a renormalized prescription of the ADS-CFT correspondence, which is applicable for the case of matter, only also with in the presence of back reaction, and deals also with the logarithmic divergences of the action, which were not taken care of before. And we found that for the bulk fields, both for the metric and scalar fields, we could solve the Einstein's equation perturbatively in R, given some boundary conditions. The expansion broke down at some order where you had to include a logarithmic piece, and this coefficient over here was related to the expectation value of the dual operator. As an aside, the types of counterterms that we find here have an interpretation as providing the action in a Randall syndrome type of scenarios. So in particular, there is a cosmological constant term, a curvature term, and also kinetic terms for the scalar fields and coupling, a mass term, etc. So as far as the discussion over about high energy is concerned, we found that one can deal with this Eichnerian regime consistently, and then one is still left with a choice of a strong and a weak curvature regime. In the weak curvature regime, the action, we could solve the equations of motion exactly, and we found ABS2, and the black hole solutions as special cases. So for the weak curvature regime and for three dimensions, the action reduces to a boundary term. We still don't have a proof in the general case. And of course, the open questions that remain are whether this boundary action that we found, whether it is in some way related to an effective action in the CFT. So that would give us some insight in the relation between holography in ADS-CFT and in this high energy scattering. Another question is about scattering amplitudes, how to make sense of scattering amplitudes in ADS, maybe by imposing boundary conditions, and whether we can reproduce those amplitudes with this method. And another approach to this holography in asymptotically flat spacetimes would be the three-brain conjecture. Although in this case, one expects a whole series of operators to appear, not only the dimension 8 operator that was conjectured, but perhaps more operators. So we are now computing alpha prime corrections to a general D-brain matrix to see what kinds of operators you find when you go higher up in energy. But this will also allow us to compute corrections to black hole entropy and say something about black hole singularities, whether they are smoothened out by alpha prime corrections or not. And that is it. Thank you.
So can you use your ADS action scattering amplitudes for short waves?
So we are not sure of that. I mean, in the Minkowski space, that action could be used to compute those amplitudes. But in this case, I mean, the question is really whether what conditions you have to impose to make sense of an S matrix. I mean, you have to impose some boundary conditions and define your Cauchy surface in a certain way. So that's quite a difficult question. I don't know the answer to that.
Any other questions?